This presentation has been previously broadcast.
The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Now to a warning for Facebook users. Your phone number and user ID information may be available to anyone willing to pay for it.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, do you have a social media account, maybe reports like the one you just heard from ABC7 in New York? Maybe chose not to be online. Good afternoon. I'm Drew Mariani. It is great to be here with you. You got to check this story out. We got a lot to get into today. We'll talk especially Divine Mercy Sunday coming up. I know a lot of people want to talk about that extraordinary day. If you're not familiar with it, stay with me. I think you'll find it eye-opening. But let me share with you right now a report from ABC7 in New York. They did a report recently on data being released from your social media account. You know, you got to be vigilant when you're online. You got to make sure that your material is protected. Listen to this report.
The trouble actually started a couple of years ago back in 2019 when a security flaw allowed hackers to grab the Facebook ID information and phone numbers of users who linked their numbers to their account. Well, now we're learning all these years later that information is reportedly for sale. Facebook knows all about the problem, and the company says it even sent out a fix to make sure it doesn't happen again. But internet security experts tell us the damage is done. According to a report from Motherboard, researchers recently learned information from more than 500 million users that was previously hacked by cyber criminals can now potentially be bought on the web for $20 a number or $5,000 get someone 10,000 numbers. It's being reported by Motherboard that the bot selling the information has been running since January 12th of this year. IT experts who we spoke with say at this point it's too late to get the information back. However, it's a perfect time to take a look at the information you've given to any other app on your phone and make sure you want that private information given to companies.
It's always good to try to go back to the sources that you have put some of this information and make sure that it's information you still want them to have.
Yeah, so some food for thought there for you. Kind of concerning, huh? I don't know if you're like me. My phone seems to ring all the time, not just my cell phone, but for some reason at home, you know, I'm getting these robocalls, and these robocalls are asking me about getting a car warranty. Jake, have you gotten any of those? Open your mic.
I have. I remember getting, I think, probably maybe two within the past month and a half, and I've just completely ignored them. I'm like, I'm not going to deal with this. But I feel really bad for the people that actually think it's their car company contacting them.
If you bought a new car, you have a new car recently, mm-hmm. That might be the case. Patrick, have you gotten any of those robocalls or not in your place? I'm not sure if you did. No? You're saying they said no. That's good because you bought a car recently. I mean, your parents, I guess. You have a pretty nice car. But no call saying, hey, we're here, letting you know your car warranty's
about to expire. I get those all the time.
That's what we're talking about. Yeah, no. What do they say? Hey, your warranty's last chance, right? Is that the
something
message?
Something like that. I've tried to delete those voicemails, too, to save space on my phone. But no, I get them all the time.
Yeah, so does Jake. So do I. And how do you respond? I mean, that's the big question. Last week, the Supreme Court ruled on a case that a lot of Americans were hoping would provide them some relief from what is really a universally hated thing, robocalls, right? My wife donated to some calls one day, right? And ever since she's done that, this particular organization called her nonstop. And we had to say to the organization at one point in time, look, don't call us again because we're not going to give to you again. It wasn't a religious organization, right? Because we said we found out that 97% of the donations that we give you, they don't go to the calls. They go to the people who are making these calls to you, right? And half the time, the robo fired up. And people just want, hey, if I'm going to donate, I want my money to go where it's going to go. Or if I'm going to, you know, give you my telephone number, I don't want to be harangued. So this Supreme Court, they ruled on a case. And instead of relief, it looks like the court opened the floodgate for more of these calls. The court ruled unanimously that the prohibition on calls was about random calls, right? Calls made by looking in the phone book and picking out a number. But calls that are made from a database, for some reason, are completely okay. So somebody sells your name, your phone number, you're in this robocall for the car warranty database. Like Patrick and Jake, like me, I'm sure you're in it too. You get these calls nonstop. So it gives telemarketers and car warranty scammers an easy out. Just put the number in your database and make the calls. Now, I do think it's time for Congress to act on that. So if you've gotten these calls, how do you respond? WCPO TV 9, give you some advice.
Have you ever answered your phone and heard something like this?
And this is a courtesy call to renew your warranty before we close the file.
It seems every day someone needs to reach you about your warranty expiring.
Hi there, this is Jessica calling in regards to your Volkswagen warranty.
Sometimes they even know the make of your car. How do they know that? They buy it from manufacturers in the state. But the FTC says buyer beware. In many cases, these are shady companies that may sell you a warranty your dealership won't honor. And from the Doesn't That Stink file, the worst thing you can do when you get these calls, pressing one or two to opt out. That tells them you are a live person, and you may get even more calls, and that stinks. Have an Apple iPhone? There's a secret setting to now block them. Go to Settings, then Phone, and look for Call Silencing. You can then silence unknown callers, and they'll just go to your voicemail. Have an Android phone? Check with your cell provider on how to block unknown calls.
All right, save that piece of audio for me, Jake. I'm going to go into my settings when the show's over on my iPhone and make sure that that...
I hope that people who were driving weren't like jotting down the notes.
Yeah, what's that? Go to my settings, go to sign.
We didn't want to cause any car crashes.
The problem
here
with that, though, is sometimes you do get unknown calls that aren't in your phone, in your contact list, so they'll go right to voicemail, too. I guess that's not a... bad thing, but it is a way to stop being harangued on your phone if you want. And if you don't answer them because they're from an old area code in California, let's say, know that that's a scam. So if you don't identify the, like I see a lot of the area codes coming in, that's Patrick, I agree that Patrick was just sending me a note. He says, don't answer me if you don't know the area code. It's true. I'm seeing him from Louisiana. I'm seeing him from all over the place. And you figure, well, I don't know anybody in that particular area. So don't pick them up. So between robocalls and 1 billion of people who use Facebook, make sure your material's secure. If you missed that, we talked about that just a minute ago. The Associated Press reported that Facebook left a half a billion of their members' information out in public view. So I hope you are safe. Just putting this on your radar, okay? A couple other items. As more of the country begins to ban the AstraZeneca vaccine because of serious issues with blood clotting, I saw a report this morning, and we talked a little bit yesterday about vaccine passports. The EU, the European Court, I should say, of Human Rights, has said that it's okay for countries to require vaccinations. And I had a conversation earlier this morning with my team, and I was saying the same thing. I said, I guarantee you we're going to see more vaccination. You're going to need a vaccine passport to travel. You really are. Maybe you haven't got one yet and you're saying, I don't want to get it. If you like to travel, you might have to do it. I saw, and I hope I'm not misquoting this, but I'm pretty sure this morning it was Norwegian Cruise Lines that I read about that are now mandating that their crew, as well as any passengers, have to be vaccinated if you're going to cruise, all right, with them. So there was a Czech family who didn't want to get their children vaccinated against a number of diseases like whooping cough and the like, and they petitioned the European Court of Human Rights to relieve them from that obligation. And the family claimed that the law was a violation of Article 8 of the EU Charter, which is it's about the right to respect, for private life. And the Court of Human Rights, which is the highest court that they can appeal to on a matter like that, they disagreed. And you know what they said about the shots? They basically said that the required shots make sure, and I'm going to quote them here, quote, every child is protected against serious disease through vaccination or by virtue of herd immunity, end of quote. And that ruling, because it just came down, could have an impact on people who just don't want to get any COVID-19 vaccinations over there in Europe. But what about our own country? What about here in our own nation? What about schools? What about not just grade schools or even high schools? You might see that coming. What about institutions of higher learning? The University of Notre Dame, I just saw this story too this fall. They said you're not going to have an option. You can't object to taking the vaccine. So you'll say, but I like the school. I like the education. I've always wanted to go there. Well, get vaccinated or you're not going to come. The university president, Father John Jenkins, announced on Wednesday that Notre Dame will require all of them, undergraduates, graduates, and professionals to be fully vaccinated as a condition of enrollment for the 21-22 academic year. So it is coming. It's creeping in. You're seeing it in different ways. I know some people who are a little concerned about their fertility, and I'm not talking vaccines right now, but I'm just saying they want to wait and see how everything shakes out with this. And if they wanted to go to that school or they had to for some reason, they'd be forced to get vaccinated. So students will also, tell the school you know, what their vaccination status is by uploading the information to a website. And that, by the way, is maintained by a third party. So Father Jenkins, again, who is the university president, he said that if 90% of the students are vaccinated in the next few weeks, they can consider making some adjustments to their health and safety protocols in the final weeks of the semester. But there will probably be more as time ultimately goes on. Let me share this with you. CNBC did a report recently on how some colleges and how some students are actually participating in a study to test whether you can transmit COVID after getting vaccinated. That's a major question, right? I'm sure you might have thought about it. If you haven't, listen to this.
Do vaccinated people still need to wear a face covering? Right now, health officials say it is safer to wear one in public since it's still not really clear if the vaccine prevents COVID-19 transmission. But researchers backed by the National Institutes of Health, they've launched a massive new effort to help answer that question. They're tracking vaccinated college students. The results could shape the future guidelines for all vaccinated Americans.
Well, it's a study they're calling Prevent COVID U, and it aims to enroll participants at 22 universities across the country using Moderna's vaccine. So why college students? Well, they live close together, they interact more, and have higher rates of infection, though relatively lower rates of severe disease. The plan? Vaccinate 6,000 volunteers immediately and another group of 6,000 4 months later. They'll all be asked to answer questions on an app and swab their noses every day and to provide periodic blood samples. But the study is not just following those 12,000 people. Additionally, about 25,000 people will be identified as their close contacts, and they too will be asked to provide samples. Dr. Fauci says this is how they aim to measure the vaccine's impact on transmission.
All right, there you have it. I'll keep you abreast of everything that is unfolding. All right, I'll make sure that you're in the know in the days ahead. As I often say when we deal with COVID-19, there's always developing news, isn't there? There's variants, there's vaccination cards, there's stories about blood clots, there's all sorts of things. But, you know, we're looking towards moving towards herd immunity, and a lot of people have gotten their shot, and we will eventually get through COVID-19. It will be in our rear view mirror one day, and I can't wait for that day to come. We have another issue, though, here in our country. I have not spent a whole lot of time talking about this. I've been following it, and I'm sure you've seen it probably in the news. I thought we should at least give some focus to this, and that's the crisis at our southern border. Unbelievable, these stories that you're now hearing that are coming in of children abandoned by their parents, and the masses just continue to rise. The issue is being highlighted by some of the awful stories coming from down there, like those, like two sisters. One 3-year-old and the other 5, right? A 3- and a 5-year-old who were dropped from the top of a 14-foot wall. I saw the footage of this. Horrible. These poor little kids, right? They apparently are going to be reunited with their parents, thank God, here in the U.S. in the near future. But there was also that 10-year-old boy you might have saw who was taken over the border by these so-called coyotes, these human traffickers and smugglers. And then, you know what? I think the kid fell asleep while they were making this long journey. Again, he's 10 years old, right? Probably hungry, exhausted. And they abandoned him in the desert. They left him. Left him to die in southern Arizona. Fortunately, there was a Customs and Border Patrol officer who came across him and was able to get him to a place where he could be helped. But this is the callous, cold disregard for human life that we're seeing. Those two stories, I think they're just the illustration of what's happening with the numbers of unaccompanied children at the border. But Border Patrol agents reported that they had seen a 100% increase in the numbers of children at the border from just February to March. You know, we're not talking a year, right? We're just talking February to March. A 100% increase. 9,500, almost 10,000 unaccompanied minors showed up in February. Well, just under 19,000 showed up last month. And the Biden administration has been caught flat-footed. You know, there's been a surge. I don't think anybody can argue about that. I'm trying to get these children into shelters. There's been some cases of abuse being reported now. But, you know, if you look at the footage, they're packed in like sardines, which is not supposed to happen, especially in this age of COVID-19. I'm joined right now by Kevin Appleby. He is a longtime advocate on immigration issues, formerly served as the International Migration Policy Director at the Center for Migration Studies in New York. And before that, he was the Director of Migration Policy and Public Affairs for our nation's bishops for the USCCB. And he joins me today, and it's always good to get his insight and expertise. Kevin, good afternoon.
Drew, it's good to talk to you again.
Thank you. Happy Easter to you, Kevin. It's good to have you back.
You too.
This surge of minors in particular, I mean, I know there'd be a surge on the border. I mean, the Biden administration, very different in its approach to migrants than the Trump administration. But I'm just curious from your perspective, why are we seeing so many unaccompanied minors? I mean, why is it that bad that parents are willing to risk the life of their child to get them to the U.S.?
Well, part of the issue is that the administration has decided to let the unaccompanied minors in, whereas when Trump was in power, he returned them based on a public health law called Section 42. He would turn them back. There is a law that's present that allows unaccompanied minors to come into the country. If they're not from Mexico or Canada, they're from a non-contiguous country, then they are required to be let in and to file for asylum. So Biden is returning back to that law. He's waiving the public health concerns. So parents are not abandoning their children in some ways. They're sending them across the border because they know that they'll be able to enter the United States and perhaps join other family members. I guess you could say they're abandoning them, but what they're doing is they're sending them to a better future.
Yeah, but you know, just on that point, I mean, to me, and again, I'm looking at this from an American perspective, right, a first world perspective, and I know the poverty, the natural disasters, the crime, all the horrors that these people have to deal with in many of those countries, and they want their kids to have a better life, but man, to send your 3-year-old and your 5-year-old or your 10-year-old unaccompanied with a bunch of coyotes, woo! I mean, that's just you. Yeah. Your situation has got to be really bad, I would think, in order to do that, because you know how a parent is with their child. I mean, that's the last thing that you probably want to do. So, hey, what is the age of a minor? Is it 16 and under, 18 and under? I mean, what are we seeing in terms of kids that are?
It's under 18. And the majority are really 14 to 17 year olds. I mean, fully 80 to 90% in the teenage range.
Right.
You do have the cases, as you mentioned, of younger children who may come with their family up to a certain point, and then the smuggler might take them across the border, or they might be with another relative.
Right.
There's not a scenario where a 5-year-old necessarily goes alone with a smuggler from Central America. They're usually with a family member, and then somehow once they get to the border, the smuggler will try to get them over. But the majority are young teenage men who are coming either because for protection or for jobs, in most cases, or to join family members. So they know that with Biden in, the coyotes say, okay, well, now we've got an administration that's going to be easier on you, time to come. And they make money off of it. So that's sort of what's happening.
So you know, the Biden administration seems to be blaming the Trump administration. It doesn't seem to make sense since all these people showed up after Trump was out of office. In fact, when they realized Joe Biden won the election, even before he was sworn in January, the caravans were already beginning to make their moves towards our border right now. In your opinion, what should the Biden administration do to get this number back down to a reasonable and manageable level to come in? And let's also talk about, what the right thing is as Americans, what we should be doing, both as Christians and as citizens, just from a moral perspective, because this is always such a tough issue, as you and I have discussed many times. I feel terrible for these people and their situation. But at the same time, you take a look at what's happening right now. It's almost unmanageable.
Yeah, that's true. Now, first of all, there was an uptick that in the surge prior to Trump leaving office. So it wasn't right when Biden took office, number one. Number two, we need to look at why people are coming. Obviously, and Biden's been saying, look at the root causes, but that's not going to be solved overnight. What needs to be done, I think, Drew, is more of a regional protection scheme where, you bring in the UN, you bring in other international organizations to screen some of the migrants, perhaps in Mexico.
My guest today,
as well as the U.S., so that might be a way to share the burden a bit.
I like that. My guest today is Kevin Appleby. We only have a few minutes, so if you want to join the conversation with Kevin, if you got a question, maybe you're living on the border, or if you have an experience, maybe you're a migrant, feel free to join us. I'm going to open the phones. It's 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. 9149. You know, when the administration finally let reporters in to the holding facilities, they found, you know, what others had, you know, surreptitiously, you know, that conditions were way overcrowded. They were pretty bleak. What's being done? I mean, are we getting new facilities? Are we trying to accommodate that? We're in a pandemic right now. Some of the footage you see is disturbing, seeing, you know, there's no room to even lay. I mean, there's people shoulder to shoulder in some of those situations. So what's happening down there right now? Are you hearing anything? And, you know, what do you see for the not-too-distant future?
Well, when the Biden administration says this is Trump's fault, what they're saying is there's not any infrastructure to handle the number of kids.
Right.
There are not enough facilities, places to put them. So they've been caught in a situation where they can't really move the kids right away until they establish more beds in different facilities, which they're trying to do. And they're trying to move these children out of the Border Patrol stations, which are horrible conditions,
yeah,
no doubt. And they'll eventually get there,
yeah,
but they're usually transferred to the Refugee Resettlement Office under Health and Human Services, and they're at capacity right now. In fact, some of the dioceses are starting to step up as well and receive kids. The Archdiocese of San Antonio, for example, is starting a program where they're receiving some of the kids. So there's an opportunity here for the church and the dioceses to step up and say, okay, we'll take some of the kids,
that's great,
you know, until their asylum case comes. But it's a question of capacity. And in some ways, the Biden administration was caught flat-footed because they didn't, you know, they knew that this could happen, but they weren't prepared to receive the numbers that are coming in.
Yeah, and just from a Catholic Christian perspective right now, Kevin, what's the church teach regarding this image, this issue of immigration? Because quite often, you know, the moral perspective is thrown out the window and it's simply looked through the lens of partisan politics when it comes to policy. So give us a Catholic perspective, if you could.
Well, the church would teach that if someone has a valid asylum claim, that they should be given due process, their claim heard, and offered protection if they're fearful of returning. As you know, the church favors immigration reform, where you have legal avenues for people to come instead of them having to come outside of the law. But of course, we haven't seen much success there recently because of the politics of the issue. And then the church says, again, you have to look at the root causes. Why are people coming? What can we do to keep them there and keep them safe and a chance to earn a living? And that's a long-term solution that we need to look at.
Well, stay with my guest today, Kevin Appleby. We are taking a look at what's happening at the border, and you are more than welcome to join us. We'll try to grab a call or two. The number's 888-914-9149. Also, great Feast of Divine Mercies this weekend. I want to fill you in on it. It's an extraordinary day. We'll talk about that coming up a little later. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
According to U.S. Customs and Border Protection, 170,000 people were apprehended at the southern border in March. That includes the nearly 19,000 migrant children who are still in federal custody.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, good afternoon and welcome. It's good to be with you today, taking a look at the situation developing on our border. We do know that several terrorists and some gang members have been apprehended trying to come across the southern border. We do know about so many minors that are making their way here as well. And you're hearing some horror stories. You're seeing some tragic video as well. But the question is, what do we do? What's the right moral response to this particular situation? Situations like this, I like to take the partisan politics out. You might have agreed with Trump. You might agree with Biden. I don't know. I don't think either one is perfect. My guest today, Kevin Appleby, and he's here to help us get that perspective. He joins us today live, and we'll take your calls at 888-914-9149. He's been a longtime advocate on these immigration issues and worked with the USCCB for a while, and it's great to have him back. And Kevin, let's just jump right in the phones. Holly is listening in Sacramento, and she's got a comment for you. Hi, Holly. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. You know, I wanted to comment on something just because you actually asked for, even if you're a migrant, to mm-hmm. see if you had a comment to reach out. So I thought of calling, and I was actually one of those children that was brought over illegally by my mother. And I was very young. I'm legal now. You know, I ended up making a life here. But I want to make a comment that, you know, everybody's situation is differently. For me, it wasn't something that it made my life better being here in the United States. I was actually almost like kidnapped from my father. My father was very well off. He was wealthy. He's wealthy now. Wow. He had a coffee plantation, and he's actually a politician now. And even now, you know, I would be better off being with my father. But growing here now, it's like I grew up now in a biracial, bicultural family. Right. So I'm very different, you know. But I wanted to point out that everybody's situation is different, and not every child that comes here wants to be here. And a lot of it is perhaps not only injustices that are in their country, but even from the family itself. Yeah. And so, I mean, I remember even being a child and not wanting to leave and being here and for years, you know, crying and wanting to leave.
Well, Holly, you bring up a great point. Thank you for calling. First of all, let's talk about that a little bit, because I would think most people don't want to leave. You know, they're forced to leave. Who wants to leave their homeland? Who wants to leave family? You know, who wants to leave their roots? You know, and conditions often will drive somebody to migrate, whether it's economics or crime or natural disaster or whatever it may be. And I'm really sorry to hear about your situation. Before I let Kevin respond to you as well, have you been in touch with your father now? You have a relationship with him or you don't?
I have now, and he has always asked me to go. But see, the thing is that, and the good thing that I could tell you about this and how providentially maybe God made it happen for me is that my dad is so well off that I see my siblings and they're just so materialistic and they're not living their Catholic faith. And me being here, I mean, I didn't live my Catholic faith even here, but when I turned 20, I went to college and I started going to Mass. I'm actually seeking a religious order right now.
Praise God.
And so me being a practicing Catholic from my reversion to the Catholic faith at 20, all the way, I'm 32 right now, but me practicing my faith all of these years is what made me, it gave me a different worldview, a Catholic worldview.
That's awesome.
And even though my father offers me all of this, I now see it through the Catholic worldview. So that's the good thing that came out of it. I think that God providentially provided me. He gave me the wealth of the Catholic faith and the church and our Blessed Mother and the Eucharist. And there's that's the real value for me. But I have been in contact with my father, but now that would be the dilemma now, but I am legal, and right now that's my journey right now.
Well, I'll tell you, well, pray for your vocation, that God leads you where he wants you. And I am grateful for your call. It's good to have you here. And I love the point you brought up, Kevin, because I do believe God brings good out of every situation. You know, even as horrible it was being separated, kidnapped from her own father. God does bring good out of that. But to her point, too, I mean, we do sometimes think that everyone wants to come and live the American dream. Let's speak to that point a little bit. I don't think everybody wants to leave their country. Quite often there are forces that drive them out. It's a pretty radical move to have to, leave family and your roots to start a new life with nothing.
Well, true. I mean, imagine if you lived here in the United States and for some reason you had to go all the way to Guatemala. I mean, wouldn't want to do that either, but they're compelled to because they're fearful for their lives or they just can't survive.
Right.
And it's the only way to survive. So at least in their minds, it's the only way to survive. So the root causes solution is the ultimate solution. The problem is it doesn't fit into the 24-hour news cycle. Unfortunately, it will take, 10 to 20 years to get these countries back to where they can sustain their people, and there's the rule of law and everything else. So in the meantime, we sort of have a dilemma, so we have to look at how we're going to reform the system so that people can come legally and we don't have crises on the border. That's really the big question before Congress.
All right, let's go to Colleen. She's in Chicago. She's got a comment for you. Hi, Colleen. Good afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. So my comment is more of just an observation. I own a landscape company in Illinois, and I have legal Mexicans, and I have a few from Honduras and things like that, and they're completely legal. And they see this completely on a different level. They are sort of seeing the illegal immigration surge and realizing that, hey, they have family members and people that are still going through the system legally.
and they share with me their stories on how long it took them to become legal, and they waited in line, and they were very patient, and they see the news, and they look at what's happening, and, you know, my whole thought is, why don't we have organizations, or why aren't we seeing more legal Mexicans and in other countries sort of getting together and saying, hey, wait, you know, it took us X amount of years. It took us a long time. Half my family is still trying to get over the legal way. Yep. I mean, if I were them and I'm looking at the people coming across, and, you know, truth be told, the people coming across, some of them are very well dressed. You know, they look like they're in great shape. They got smiles on their face. You know, is there an organization or have these people started to sort of rally across the country to say, hey, let's form sort of an alliance to say, hold on a second, and tell the administration, what about us? What about the people that did the right thing?
Right. Now, I guess you're the voice, I'm sure, of a lot of people
out
there.
I employ a lot of them, and they all look at it, and they're all Trump supporters.
Yeah. Well, Kevin,
they don't want this.
Thanks, Colleen. Let's talk about that a little bit. She brings up another great point. I mean, if I had to wait 10 years to become a citizen, and I see people kind of taking a shorter route, it's frustrating. Your thoughts to her comments?
Well, the basic fact is there are not enough legal avenues to meet the demand. I'm sure her workers came legally. They might have waited, but there are thousands and thousands of more who are still waiting in line because the system's slow and there are not enough slots every year. I mean, for a family, if I came in as a family member, for example, and I was, say I had a green card in my family, I was Mexican, I had a green card, I lived in Tucson, but my family was in Nogales across the border, it would still take 7 to 8 years legally for someone for my family to join me. So, I mean, most aren't going to wait that long. So, as I said, we need to look at the legal immigration system, how it's working. We need to look at these temporary worker programs. How can those work properly so people can come seasonally and maybe go back if they want? They've been corrupt in the past. Can we create a system where people can come and work and then maybe go home and then come back? That's a big issue that hasn't been solved and needs to be moving forward. So basically, the system can't handle the demand.
Right.
And frankly, the demand that we need sometimes in some of these industries, we need immigrant workers, and we're not meeting them. So sometimes there are undocumented workers picking the fruit, right?
Yeah. So. Hey, Colleen, thank you. I got to move along because I only have a few moments. Kimberly's in San Diego listening. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, Drew. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I actually have a question for you, I think, for seeking your advice or counsel. I live in San Diego, and recently our convention center had been kind of turned into makeshift housing for the homeless during the whole COVID thing last year. And just recently, they came in and removed all the homeless to make room for all of the children that are now here. And as a Christian, of course, anybody who's homeless or needs to be fed or clothed or sheltered, I believe I'm called to help anybody, but I'm kind of perplexed with that because I have a passion for the homeless, and I feel like we kicked out our family in order to take in my next door neighbor and their children. And I don't want to, of course, somehow, some way they should be taken care of. I don't think they should just be put out onto the street,
Kimberly,
in any way, shape or form.
Where did they put the homeless? Do you know where they relocated them?
No, they were done. I mean, some of them were able to go into like other shelters and whatnot, but they weren't necessarily all relocated.
Right? Yeah, it's tough. See, just my own from what you're saying, and again, I don't know what they did with all the homeless. Whether there's other shelters or churches or agencies or individuals who picked them up, but. Yeah, I understand your frustration, and Kevin, you can speak to this as well. The I don't think it's either or, really, whether they are fellow citizens or whether they're migrants. If these are people in need, I think we do have a moral obligation, if they are here, to see what we can do to help them. And, you know, I would hope, Kimberly, that, you know, our churches are doing more, and I know there are some, you know, parishes that are taking in the homeless, and they are helping with some of these migrants as well. And I think as individuals as well, I think of Mother Teresa and what she did. She'd go to the streets and she helped as many people as she could. So often as an American, we're so comfortable where we are, we never think of reaching out to somebody that's on the streets. Even if it's just, you know, not necessarily bring them into your home, but get them to a place that needed some sort of some support. And Kevin, your thoughts on that as well. You understand the frustration. A lot of people say, hey, these migrants are coming over. America first, yeah, other citizens second. And you can kind of understand that. A lot of these people, once they're here and across the border, I put them almost in the same category as somebody who's on the street because they're broke or have mental illness or addiction or something else. I mean, they really need the help of their fellow man.
Right. And I don't know all the circumstances of the San Diego situation. Kimberly laid it out pretty well. You know, we could debate the whole homeless issue and why we're the richest country in the world and we have homeless in the first place. But I won't even attempt to do that. But it's part of the debate in immigration that, you know, you have foreign-born people coming here sometimes outside the law, and they're pitted against those who are at the lower end of the economic ladder. And it's a problem. It's something that we need to address on both sides. And I think there's room enough for everyone, but we need to look at those policies independently and say, how can we reduce the homeless in this country and not have to put them in a convention center in the first place? So it's a difficult issue. It's something that we have to grapple with and seek some real solutions for.
Okay. Well, Kevin, I want to thank you for your time. Always great to talk with you. And this is an issue, of course, that's not going to go away. I think we're going to have more conversations about this in the future because we see numbers continuing to rise. And, you know, I know the church has a responsibility. We personally have a responsibility as a nation. We've got to get this right, too, and hopefully we can come up with a solution that works. So, but thank you for your clarity all the time. Sure. It's good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Drew.
All right. It's Kevin Appleby. It's about 18 minutes before the top of the hour. I have to take a short pause. When we come back, I do have to change gears slightly. We are going to talk, a little Divine Mercy. Big weekend, right? This is a huge, huge weekend for Divine Mercy. It's the Feast of Divine Mercy. I want to get you plugged into that. We're going to be joined by the Moronis. I'll be stopping by as well. We'll pray the chaplet live. But just a quick programming note, and I want to make you aware of this too. After the Feast of Mercy, I don't think there are going to be any books left. I know we're down to, you know, a few remaining at this particular point in time. So they did a print run. Most of them are accounted for. And I just want to tell you, this book on Divine Mercy is a must for your spiritual library. I believe that personally. Not because I wrote it, because honestly, I could have threw another 400 pages at this. I only scratched the surface of Divine Mercy. And as I talk more about it, sometimes I think, oh man, I should have threw this in there. I should have talked about Faustina suffering. I should have talked about this encounter she had with the dogs that wanted to attack her. I go through all these different things, right? I put what I felt was most important for you. And I want you to have it. And this is going to be the last day I'm probably going to, you know, put this on your radar. The book is free. Okay, it's absolutely free. No expenses at all for you. Relevant's going to cover the shipping and handling. They're going to send it right to you. But if you have signed up already, then get somebody else to sign up and take advantage of these few remaining books that we have left and give it to somebody. Maybe you can make it a gift to your pastor or to some nurse or somebody in a hospice ministry or somebody who's struggling with the faith or somebody who's, you know, who just might need to understand that God's love and his mercy is unfathomable, somebody who can't forgive themselves. Maybe you have a prison ministry. So many great applications for this book. Here's what you have to do. Go today and do it now, okay? I'll be talking about this a little bit more throughout the show today, but then that's it. Relevantradio.com, okay? Relevantradio.com. Just sign up. And maybe have your daughter sign up or have your neighbor or your, you know, one of your fellow teachers or somebody you work out with or somebody at work say, hey, the book is free. Why don't you get it, give it to your kid, make it a gift to the parish, whatever. Send it to a library. And again, we didn't charge for the book. I mean, this is totally free, shipping and handling too. There's no strings attached to this. We just want you to have the book, and it's our way of giving it to you. So relevantradio.com, go and sign up, or maybe use your mobile app as well. The Moronis are going to be stopping by. They'll be with me in a few minutes. When we come back, I'll be joined by a Catholic priest. Speaking of Divine Mercy, it's going to kind of be a Divine Mercy day. If you have children and you want to introduce them to Divine Mercy, he's done a series of little videos, which I think are going to be awesome. Great ways to be inspired by God's mercy. All right, Father Stephen will be with me when I return. And, of course, we'll take your calls and questions, and we'll pray live in just a minute, all right? More straight ahead. Don't go away.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Boy, time flies, doesn't it? Divine Mercy Sunday is coming up. We'll talk a lot more about that today. I'll get you plugged into one of the most powerful days, I think, on the church calendar. And of course, you might have children. And I think one of the great things as parents, we are primary educators of our children. We instill the faith in them. Maybe you can begin to plant those seeds of mercy in the hearts of your children now as you're young. Because mercy, this devotion is not just for grown-ups. And I think it's important to teach children about God's mercy. You know, it's important for them to grow up, to live as witnesses to God's divine mercy. And I'm joined today by a friend of mine. He's a priest. His name's Father Stephen Lesdesky. He is the author of a number of books on the Eucharist. He spent many years counseling women outside of abortion clinics. And you might have seen the film To Be Born. He's the executive producer of that. And he just came out with not only a children's book on mercy, but series of videos that will inspire you as well, taking quotes from the diary of St. Faustina. And he's here today as we dive into divine mercy. Father, it's great to have you. Good afternoon.
Oh, it's wonderful to be with you, Jerome. I'm so happy to be with you guys today.
Well, and I love what you're doing. I love your, first of all, thank you for your pro-life work, because I know you've been very adamant in that. You and I have spent some time together years ago. I know you wrote a book on divine mercy, and I shared many of the miracles that took place through the chaplet, and now you're working on something to introduce children to divine mercy, as well as these videos as well. I think introducing the message of St. Faustina and the revelation God gave to her of his mercy is so important. How are you doing that? How do you do that in a way that will inspire our children to come and to love God's mercy?
Well, I think sooner the better, as you know, all parents know, to get to the children. And so, you know, you teach through tools. And so I think this book will be a beautiful book called Divine Mercy for Children, and it's an introduction of divine mercy. So, no, children are great intercessors. You read about St. Faustina in the diary, and it says that a soul that glorifies my mercy more than anyone is one who trusts. And when you look at children, how they trust is amazing, and how they have to suffer, you know, going to bed when you have to go to bed, eating what you don't want to eat, being nice to your brothers and sisters when they're nice to you. And so, and shows that they could bring mercy upon the world. It says a soul that's full of mercy and trust will be an ocean of mercy. And so it's to get these children, you know, on board when they're young, you know. And when they're young, they're like little sponges. They really want to listen, and they want to be open to it. So I think this book has beautiful pictures in it. And it tells a story about Faustina, who she is, where she came from. It also tells, you know, how when you pray, how the holy souls are helped. And tell stories where St. Faustina went and the souls would appear and thank her when they're praying for those in purgatory. And those who are dying, how even the devils leave when you're praying. So Children are fascinated by stories. So it has nice little stories in there. And then it actually has pictures, coloring pictures, where kids could interact with the book itself. So I think it's going to really help kids to love mercy the first time in their lives.
Are children more receptive to the message of mercy, do you think? I mean, at that age, I know.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you tell kids anything, they believe you, you know, good or bad. And so if you tell them, you know, mercy, that you're important. You're not just a kid, get our way, you know, let the adults talk and do what we want. Kids are so precious. Their prayers are so powerful, interceding. Let me give you an example. One day I was driving my van. We were going to a picnic for the parish, and I had my foot on the brake. And then slowly I just let up for a second, and I gave a kiss a little to the bumper of the car in front.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, geez. And I looked out, and there was nothing there. And I said, sorry, sir. And he started screaming, oh, my back, I'm paralyzed. I go, sir, I could barely touch you. What are you talking about? He says, call an ambulance. I said, oh, no, I'm in trouble.
Oh, man.
So we had a van of children. And I said, children, would you start praying, please? So they start praying. I think they start praying the rosary. And they said, please help Father Stephen. And the ambulance truck came out of nowhere. And he says, sorry, Father, I can think of the hospital. And then after the kids were praying about 5 minutes, he says, the guy decided he's fine. Leave, you know, you could go. And I believe it because these children were praying.
Oh, wow.
I didn't get it myself in a huge lawsuit because of this. It looked like a big fraud coming in my way.
Wow. You're not kidding.
Kids are very powerful.
Yeah, now the prayers of a child, I think, go right to the heart of God. I mean, he hears them in a big way. And, you know, children, of course, when they're young like that, are very open, very trusting, and that's really the key to a lot of the devotion. Then the teen years come along, Father. And then once these kids become teenagers, all bets are off. Any ideas of what parents can do to help their children keep that I don't know, that that holiness, that innocence, that love for God?
Well, thank God I've been a priest for like 27 years. I've worked with children, and now I've seen them grow older, and now they're teenagers, and many of them stay good because you got them when you're young, and you can maintain that communication with their parents, that love, and they have the rooted belief that, you know, that, that there is a God, he loves them, and God needs, and we need mercy because we're all sinners, and there is a justice if we don't ask for mercy. And so they believe in those rules and those realities, and then they grow up as teenagers. So you if you continue with that love and that communication and the faith is continued taught, they don't have to go through huge, you know, crises as teenagers that walk from the faith. But I think the foundation is really good when they're young, to truly teach them about God's love and to teach them their faith and the importance of praying and the importance of, you know, of hearing morality, conscience, and all that goes together. So I think most of these kids, what I see when they're young, they're good kids, but they didn't really understand the Gospels. They didn't really understand their commandments really well. And so parents thought they taught them, bring them the catechism and going to church, that's enough, but they didn't check out, you know, and talk to them and communicate with them and made you know, faith something beautiful and something alive, you know, stories of the saints, the story of Faustina. And the children usually won't lose it, but I don't think at the beginning they really didn't have it, because you look at kids who make the confirmation, they can't even find a saint's name or know anything about the saints. So it's like, it shows me like when they're young, they didn't have any life, you know, spirituality of the beauty of the saints. So I think it's get them when they're young and just keep going and persevere. And I think, you know, the average are going to stay good.
Father, how did you fall in love with Divine Mercy? How were you introduced to it? Because you've been following it for quite a while now.
Yeah, I think it's just the grace of God. I really can't think for sure. I remember when I was ordained, I wanted the beautiful image of the Sacred Heart on my ordination card. Yep. I couldn't get it. I know the one I wanted, but then I saw Divine Mercy, and it touched my heart. The beauty, wow, the beauty of the big picture of Divine Mercy. And so there's in 93, and it was just so.
Wow.
When I learned about it, I said how beautiful it is, wow, how wonderful it is. It, you know, God's mercy is so great. How, you know, he's such a, you know, good, loving God, and how the world is in need of great mercy. So from there on, you know, in my life as a priest, when you talk to people in confessional, you just talk about God's own love. More than anything else, just God's mercy, you could see, warms their hearts and gives them confidence to come back and love God again. So it's something, my own experience in my life, and when I work with people, when you offer them the mercy of God, it really opens their heart to come back to God.
You know what I find fascinating? 1993, I think that is the year that St. Faustina was actually beatified. She was, I think, April 18th in St. Peter's Square.
Wow.
So the fact that you had been touched by God to spread Divine Mercy, or at least to be connected to it, before she was even made a saint, really speaks about the grace. I was the same way. I mean, I was introduced to it years ago. I was hired to do a documentary on Divine Mercy when I was making documentaries, and that's how I came to learn of the devotion, and I was there at that beatification, which is absolutely amazing. Father, I have a couple minutes left, and by the way, there's somebody who wants to talk to you, so when we wrap up, don't go anywhere. It's an old friend of yours, okay?
Sure.
So I'm going to connect you. But before we... Before we do that, you know, I've seen, I think, maybe one or two videos that you have done on Divine Mercy, and they're actually really well done. What are you doing with those? I just want to get people in touch with this whole aspect of mercy. Is this going to be something you're going to try to teach the message of mercy through these short form videos? What are you doing?
Yeah, the videos are meditations. They're beautiful meditations on an adaptation on the story on the diary of Faustina. And when you read them, you get a little message of forgiveness, trust, having courage, being humble. And they're like little episodes, little meditations. They're 1 to 2 minutes. They're not like long films, but you put them, you're going to get them. If you go on mercyclips.com, they're going to have the first one will come out this Sunday. So if
cool.
you sign up, then you would be notified, you know. And so, and then... And this is where you could get the book, Mercy, that I've written, Mercy for Children, on Divine Mercy for Children. And then these clips are so touching. People, we saw a few. I didn't make them. You know, I just helped write a little bit of it. But, you know, I have a producer, Ed, who did a wonderful job.
Yeah.
And he's working on, I think, what we're done, hopefully, in the end of
That's
April
great.
Or May. And we're going to have 23 of them all together. Yeah. And so if they sign up,
yeah.
they're very touching. People saw it. They said their hearts are warm. Some people
wow.
are brought to tears. and if it's like a dramatization of a nun. She plays the, and it's like a with music, and it shows a beautiful image of Faustina, and it's really touching.
Well, I'll tell you what, Father, I'm out of time for today, but let's have you back at some point in the future. We can certainly talk more about that. I want to support anybody who promotes the message of mercy. It's so important today in our culture, and I'm grateful for all that you are doing. Stay on the line, though, because there's somebody who does want to talk to you, okay? And always good to talk. That's Father Stephen Lesneski, and a great guy who has been devoted to spreading the message of divine mercy. He's been a great priest who's done a lot for the cause of life and uses his talent and his resources, both in print and in production, to draw others, you know, closer to God. And say a prayer for him and for the mission that he's done. And you can check out his videos, too. I think he said it was mercyclips.com. I think they're there, so we'll see. I have less than a minute to go. We'll pray the chaplet when we come back. And look, this Sunday is the great feast of divine mercy. Father Rocky and I are going to be praying the chaplet together on Mercy Sunday, and Father will lead us in some other spiritual exercises, not the right word, spiritual devotions, if you will. And it'll be a day of great prayer. So we'll hang out together on Sunday, and you can join me live that day. Don't forget, this is one of the last days for you to get my book on divine mercy. All right. And if you want it, relevantradio.com. If you already have it, do somebody else a favor. Spread the message of mercy. Reach out to them. Have them sign up at relevantradio.com. The books have been printed. There's only a few of them now left. I want to make sure everybody has one. After the Feast of Mercy, I don't think they'll be available. So last chance, right? Take advantage of it. All right. We'll pray the chaplet when we come back. Hang out with me.